Someone thought you said ratty schoolhouse.
You want to stand or
sit? I want to stand.
Okay.
Don't forget the book Rabbits of the Air. Remember? The last time I read here, our maestro called my book Rabbits of the Air, but it's really Rabbis of the Air. But I'm changing it because I like Rabbits of the Air better. It works a lot better. Especially if you haven't read the book. It works better. Thank you so much. It's an honor to read here. I read here the first time I ever moved around here. I read at Hemingway's like 20-odd years ago. And wow, it's such an honor, such a wonderful thing for this to last this long. Thank you, Joan. And Jimmy, how about a hand for them? What about it? Yeah. Thank you. And Christine Stroud, thank you for those Autumn House books, too. Michael and Christine. All right, New and Selected. Joan said it was a fantastic book. I can't help but agree. Kidding. No, I'm not. So if you want me to get home with gas money, please buy one. And as a taste, I'm going to give you the title poem. And by the way, thanks to so many friends here. My God, thank you. Our Portion, which is in different sections, and it's a spring poem. And every year, my wife and I, when it's about spring coming and around April, we look for the trillium. Though we didn't know it at the time, the purpose of the walk was the bluebird. Hiking for first signs of spring, the swampy skunk cabbage, mayflowers, green umbrellas, imagining trilliums, three petals, white or pink, imagining Jack in the pulpits and Georgia O'Keeffe. These few hours of early spring, imagining the dogwood's white brevities, and in a patch of woods, in the center of everything, a blossom, blue, and I called your name. It waited, you looked up, and then it flew off. God kissed me and gave me breath. You kissed me and took it away. All we ask for is time, more of it. We're greedy for it. We skipped work and crossed Sandy Creek. We took advantage of the one day of sunlight. What is this thing, this being alive and well? Why has this happiness arrived and stayed? What are these gifts of ours tumbling as if out of some exhausted cloud? These hours we fritter away, waiting for the school bus, our days revolving, the way the world spins to a child who's just spun senselessly because she is a child. It's already a song, says the robin in the hydrangea, or a sweet odor, says the Madonna lily to the crowd of bee balm, or a softening of the air, says the yellow swallowtail, or a dusking of the light, says the unfathomable sky. Where will the butterfly lean our attention as it skitters lightly across the tip-tops of the corn stalks? And how our journey is determined, destination by destination? And how is it possible to forget about the dead, negligent creatures that we are, the way a loved one disappears into a distance we are incapable of distinguishing? The world acquires flavor only when a little of the other world is mingled into it, like that blue jay in the blueberry bush, flapping its wings, screeching to be freed from the black netting secured with wooden clothespins. When I approached with my copper pot and visions of pie a la mode, I knew it was my task to release him, ashamed as he was, shrieking from one end of the bush to the other, feathers floating. I unpinned the netting, carefully turned it over, silently spoke the bird toward the opening, though it lingered, sacrificing the sky for its hunger. So the most proper study is outdoors, the hummingbird dipping its needle beak into the open mouth of the morning glory, the retriever dashing off in a flash and rolling in the scent of dead skunk. If I can follow through like that, the way she burrows into a deer's abandoned ribcage, whittling the bones down all afternoon and into the evening. She knows the wisdom of the masters, but I flounder. Following the forms of dailiness, coffee and paper, breakfast and school bus, the long arc of work, the supper, a situation comedy, and, after the children are asleep, thick novels, longing. Did you study the wisdoms? Was your business honorable? That's what will be required of you. Did you sing your portion of sunlight, of looking through windows, morning into afternoons, the whole day yours, spreading itself into evening, and suddenly the music of crickets, a hummingbird's worth of air, the portion you were allotted, the dust mote of your existence. So, if it all depends on the miraculous, the blue jay shrieking from the cornstalks, the woodpecker nosediving into the spruce, the small maple leaf tossed onto my notebook for luck, I hope, for long life and love, thinking this page is the earth, that in time it will turn into soil and grow back again, half in shadow, half in light. Then must one abandon one's affairs and enter into the garden's palace? Those sages said they spend their life searching for truth, while others have wasted their substance on love, the way, let us confess, we bite into our hours, we chew the minutes, we swallow the seconds, because the willow knows its secret but isn't telling, and the grapevine doesn't hesitate to expand itself. And in the wind's book we read, remember your fate, the one about that's all she wrote. Call it the dream or the carrying forth. Call it the seasonal reach, edgeless, gathering and feasting, touching a while, by accident or grace. Call it our portion. We are not nothing. We are transmigratory souls. Thank you. When I was trying to figure out a title for the book, I opened the book to a page and it said, call it our portion. I said, okay, I'll call it our portion. All right, I'm going to touch on some of the themes that were mentioned tonight. Somebody mentioned King David. That was you. Michelangelo. You mentioned Michelangelo when you mentioned Muhammad Ali. Somebody mentioned Florence. That was Rick, wherever he is. So I thought I'd read this poem. Kobe Bryant competes with King David at the Galleria dell'Accademia. Anybody seen King David over at the gallery in Florence? I know we've all seen Kobe Bryant. The crowd circles around the masterpiece, around and around, wondering how something this beautiful can be possible, this perfectly shaped human that so astounds us, we wish to protect it from the vibrations of our own footsteps. Suddenly, all eyes shift and stare at this familiar figure of famous flesh and blood, wearing a purple Laker shorts and shaking tourists' hands, a modern hero stealing our attention from the one we've waited in line to view all morning and into the afternoon, the shepherd boy who inquired of King Saul about that uncircumcised 9-foot bronze-helmeted Philistine. Who does this Goliath think he is? David spat out, to defy the ranks of a living God. So he gathered his sticks and smooth stones and became a stone himself, defending the liberties of Florence, his eyes permanently fixed, daring Rome, the way Kobe measures, double covered, the angle and distance of the swish. Now, a torn ligament, he's out for the season, and some commentators are suggesting that at 37, maybe he should retire. Well, he listened to him earlier. I was, weren't you, Kobe, scoring all those points in my parents' back of the house b-ball court, shooting my famous jumpers and foul shots all day at the splintered blackboard and netless rusty rim until dusk blurred into dark and the ball shattered one of the garage windows and my father yelled that was enough for the day. Meanwhile, the future king maintains his slingshot position, the marble muscles preserved, we hope, for another 1,000 years. Thanks. I want to touch on another poem conversation. Rick mentioned, read a couple poems about related to adoption. And so I'm going to read a poem from the book of the Unbroken Days, which is included in this thing. The title pretty much says it all, all the explanation you need. My Russian Jewish grandparents and the birth parents of our Chinese child meet at a cafe and discuss our child's future. Got that? Maybe you should just stop there. Stop while you're ahead. Shmuel and Malka and our child's Chinese birth parents are sipping tea at a cafe somewhere between the Pale Settlement of Russia and central rural China. They speak in signs and gestures, swirling arms like dancers, shaping fingers into figures, standing up and swaying, contorting bodies to emphasize some obscure point, even employing pauses and long silences to further the conversation. The men gesture. My grandfather's yarmulke is as black as I imagine our child's birth father's hair. The women continue to fill their husbands' cups and stare off into the distance. The men agree on the major issue. Each will have to sacrifice their darlings, their children, send them away across miles of land and ocean into a realm farther and more unfamiliar than they could understand, even in their own tongue, a place perhaps like those faraway and never, never lands in the stories of each of their childhoods, palace on a cloud, temple beyond the stars, Jerusalem, or Shangri-La. It's better to think of that strange country this way than to ponder the potential dangers, strangers in strange lands, years of forced labor, the poverty and destitution they themselves know something about, each in their own way, these farmers and peddlers, each of them know dark to dark. Their gestures are more subtle and sophisticated now. They even forget and sometimes break out into their Yiddish and Mandarin, which sounds as exotic as a gathering of multicolored birds singing through the tea's steam. The bill, which is grief, arrives. They agree to split it. They accompany each other to the gate that opens out into their separate centuries. Through unfathomable signs, they agree to meet again. Thank you. All right. So I'm trying to read a little section from each of these books that are in here. And so this one's from the Torah Garden. That one was Rabbis of the Air. Okay, how about one? Do we have time for a couple more? Okay. All right. Hasidim, you know, those are the Orthodox Jews, right, with the black. It's kind of like two women are talking, and one says, I can't find a good Jewish guy in this town, right? And the Orthodox Jew walks by, and the other woman says, what about that guy? Too Jewish. You know that one, right? Hasidim in New Square, New York, hear Karp speaking Hebrew. Latest miracle. Back of a local fish market, a carp opened its mouth and declared, I am the soul of a dead childless Jew. I was sent to do good deeds on earth. It spoke first to its executioner, Louis Navalno, one of the non-believers, just as it was about to be gutted. The fish is talking, Navalno screamed. Zalman Rosen, his boss, rushed into the room, and the fish in the ancient tongue confirmed, yes, I am the soul of a departed Jew. Come back to relieve your burdens, to heal your sick of heart, to give strength to the weary. Then it slid into the fish pile. Attempts to recover it were fruitless. One carp looking so much like another. The way they can slip and slide until lost among the school. When the workers called in their ache to reaffirm, why didn't it respond? Why didn't it raise its voice out of the heap of its inarticulate brethren and distinguish itself again? So it was sold with the rest. Some believe it was as the parting of the Red Sea, as the giving of the commandments. Reports spread. A carp spoke God's word. The Messiah is coming. Such was the rumor. The local rabbi decreed to honor this wonder, everyone should not eat carp for a week. True.
True story.
Thank you. One more, and then we're good. One, uno more.
Let's see. Okay, this is a...
Huh?
Una más.
It's going to be a good one, though. It's a new one. Therefore, Raven Slaughter and the Dream Machine. This is when you're in high school and you want to be a star, right? We can hear him a block away in the warehouse district, downtown, corner of Chester and Euclid Avenue. I had gathered my verses, finagled my father's old used olds, locked the doors he commanded, roll up the windows. Mid-70s, the riot still singed in his memory, Cleveland a ghost town, from University Circle to the Terminal Tower. A large patch of dark, a few stragglers, a lead guitar screeching through the dimly lit windows, drums punneling like my pulse, 17 years old and full of fear and thrill, descending into the depths of what my parents drilled into me as dangerous, but fancying myself a lyricist, not because it made more money than poetry, but after failing at drums and guitar, I knew the closest I'd come to girls and fame would be whatever I could muster in story and rhyme. After all, I was the go-to guy for sonnets. The jocks and freaks were assigned. So I placed an ad in the Scene magazine, lyricist looking for a band, and the one call came, a soft voice, whispering he had great chords, but what he needed was words. Shaking to the music or to the jitters, I banged on the iron door and he appeared. Long, straight, black hair, dressed in black, 6-inch Cuban heels, leading me into the cavern. Huge amp and 3 guitars. And, slouched on the couch in the corner, a real thin, barely clad blonde, reading a book about Marilyn Monroe. Let's see him, he demanded. I handed him the lyrics, typed up, alphabetically arranged in the blue folder, with titles like Brotherhood, The Dream Machine, Religion Without God. Flaying at his strings, he stuttered out the first of my words. Hit me once before I go. I can't face the streets alone. Then he screeched to a stop and stared straight at me. What the fuck does this mean anyway? It's a hit of pot, isn't it? My manager says no drugs, no glitter. What did I know? I must have sensed that these rhyme confessions, quickly scribbled in a teenage angst, would get me nowhere. But at that age, we'd do anything that had any chance, even the slightest, to take us away from school and into the imagined fantasy we had to believe in or go crazy. And so when Raven asked if he could hold on to them, that was enough, more than enough, when I saw a month later, an ad in the Scene appearing at the Euclid Tavern. Raven Slaughter and the Dream Machine. Thank you.